Thank you, Leonard. Before I start, all around the tables, I have placed a Xerox of a Chicago Tribune article that I hope you can take a look at and share, because my purpose today was to take a 20-minute look at the conceptualization of liberty in what one might call a transatlantic battlefield of ideas before and during the early stages of the Spanish colonization of the Americas. But yesterday I read something in the Chicago Tribune that I wanted to share with you, taking 5 minutes away from my talk to do so. It has to do with the Nobel Prize given to a French writer, Jean-Marie Gustave Leclésio. And this piece of news has to do with the Americas. This French writer happens to live in Albuquerque, and I will restrain myself from making comments about that fact. The other interesting part of this piece of news is a paragraph here that reads, "The selection marked another year in which the Academy declined to pick better-known literary figures who have yet to be honored, such as Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa." And of course, Vargas Llosa is in good company in this regard, because the Swedish Academy also failed to give the prize to Jorge Luis Borges, and for the same reasons, neither of them is considered sufficiently progressive. The third part of the article I have circled. It's in the second column from the left, and it's part of a paragraph taken from this book written by the French writer. It's called The Mexican Dream. Apparently, this French writer writes what is called historical fiction. And this paragraph is fascinating. It probably holds the record for the most numerous number of blunders in two sentences that I have seen. So I went through the editor and I went through the Swedish Academy. Well, let me read it for you, for those of you who don't have it. It's at the bottom of the excerpt there, two sentences. "It is difficult to imagine the Mexicans' terror when they first saw armored horsemen galloping toward them, brandishing long, threatening spears. This first apparition must have been as terrifying as the elephants of Alexander's army." Can anyone point out at least one of the blunders there? What elephants? There were no elephants in Alexander's army, sir. Alexander's army faced an army of elephants, of King Poro, when Alexander attacked India, and he crushed them, elephants and everything else. Anything else you notice there? No, they did have long spears, but they were not armored. This is a common error. The Spaniards were not wearing armor, ladies and gentlemen. In Europe, you could wear armor, but if you wore armor in the heat and the humidity of Central America and Mexico, you would die. And the Spaniards discovered that soon enough. The metal would rust, and the armor created too much heat for the interminable marches and the constant battles. So the Spaniards discarded the armor, and instead they put on the armor that the native warriors wore, which was cotton armor, which was good enough to stop the arrows. So you were safe as long as an arrow didn't get on you outside the peto of cotton. You were all right. So that's the second blunder from this historical writer. And the third one is that, let me read the sentence again, "It is difficult to imagine the Mexicans' terror when they first saw armor." Well, by the time the Mexicans engaged the Spaniards in battle, they had known the Spaniards for many, many weeks. In fact, the Spaniards' first battles were not against the Mexicans. The Spaniards' first battles were against natives from the northern coast of what is today Guatemala. They were the Sempoalans, and they were terrific warriors, but the Spaniards beat them. That's where the first warriors the Spaniards met. And by the time Cortes and his men entered the Mexica Empire proper, Moctezuma already knew everything. He had a tremendous network of spies. So this is nonsense. The Mexica knew perfectly well what the Spaniards were capable of, which is the reason why Moctezuma did not engage them until they were inside Tenochtitlan, and then not Moctezuma, but his successors did attack the Spaniards successfully within a city. They could never beat them in the open field. So this is amazing. This, in two sentences, a record of blunders. But let me go back to my purpose, which, as I said, was to spend time looking at the conceptualization of liberty in this transatlantic battlefield of ideas. And first, I will give a few examples from a pre-Columbian culture, and then examine briefly, very briefly, the Las Casas Sepúlveda controversy in the mid-16th century in Valladolid. Let me begin by saying that we have no evidence that pre-Columbian cultures ever entertained theoretically, and I emphasize the word theoretically, the idea that men should be free and that it is immoral to deprive them of their liberty. In fact, all the evidence we have points in the opposite direction, namely that Amerindians did not think it was wrong to enslave other people and even some of one's own people. The examples from Amerindian cultures I have chosen are taken from the oral traditions of the Inca, collected by the great 17th century writer Inca Garcilaso de la Vega, the son of a conquistador and an Inca princess. These writings of Inca Garcilaso are known as the Comentarios Reales, or Royal Commentaries. And these are the only Amerindian traditions I know of that deal with anything like political theory in general and statecraft in particular. These traditions are very revealing, however, of the ethos that animated the Inca rulers on the subject that is of interest to us. The Comentarios reproduce familiar arguments used by conquerors throughout history to trumpet the beneficent effects of conquest upon the conquered, the gratitude that the conquered must feel for their loss of liberty, the regrettable but necessarily ruthless measures that sometimes must be taken against them for their own good. One may notice how the Inca ruler's concept of civilization is universalized, thus repressing an alternative conception that undoubtedly already existed in highly sophisticated social organizations such as those of the Chachapoyas or the Churajon or the Chancas before the Incas civilized them. The first excerpt that I have is one that reads briefly, "It is necessary to know that before the Inca arrived to enlighten the Indians, in that early age and ancient gentility, there were Indians little better than tamed beasts and other Indians worse than ferocious beasts." And shortly afterwards, Garcilaso tells again, remember, Garcilaso is reproducing oral traditions that his Inca family, especially an uncle, have been giving him about the Inca past. So afterwards, Garcilaso tells again of the brutal ways of the Indians before the benefic arrival of the Incas. "The people of those times lived like wild beasts and brute animals, without religion or laws, without town or house, without cultivating or seeding the earth, without clothes or covering of their naked flesh, because they did not know how to process cotton or wool to make garments." And here Garcilaso, you may notice, has presented the standard colonialist maneuver of showing the backwardness of the conquered before the conquerors come to civilize them. And the narrative turns to the pre-Inca religion, telling us how barbaric the gods of the pre-Inca nations were, again in a familiar imperialist move. I quote, according to the other simple and brutal ways they had, as much in their sheer numbers as in the vileness and lowliness of the things they worshipped, as was the vileness and the lowliness of their gods, so was the cruelty and barbarism of the sacrifices done in that ancient idolatry. Because the Inca cannot allow this situation to continue, and so the Inca god sends down two of his children to help the world. Providentially and very conveniently for the Inca royalty and nobility, these children were the first Incas. And from them all the Inca rulers happened to descend, making the Inca ruling class not only direct descendants of God, but his anointed instruments in his beneficent designs. And I quote, our father the sun, for such was the language of the Incas and the veneration and obedience whenever they referred to the sun, because they were proud to descend from him. Our father the sun, seeing such men as I have told you, had pity on them and sent from the heavens to the earth a son and a daughter of his. Now this is a passage which is very interesting because the characteristically phallocentric and therefore patriarchal ways of sun god worshippers showing the method used by the first Incas, children of the sun god, to find the site of their rule, namely sticking a bar into the mother earth. Listen. And he told them to go wherever they wanted, and wherever they stopped to eat or sleep, that they tried to push into the ground a small bar of gold, half a yard long and 2 fingers thick, that he had given them as a sign and insignia. End of quote. The first Inca rulers organized their initially converted Indians hierarchically into classes, giving more power to those Indians the rulers considered more obedient and diligent in forcing other Indians to submit to the Inca, and therefore more worthy of receiving power from the Inca, with instructions to keep ethnic and family purity intact in a characteristically ethnocentric maneuver destined to strengthen Inca rule and prevent its dilution by racial miscegenation. And I quote, the differences the Inca ordered to exist among the insignias in addition were signals so that the nations and the lineages would not be mixed, that those who he had seen more docile to his doctrine and had worked the hardest to reduce the other Indians to subjection, those he had likened the most to his own persona in the insignias, and to them he has granted the biggest favors. And this goal of ethnic purity explains the Inca rulers' practice of marrying their sisters to produce the next always male Inca heir, although the Inca ruler could have many non-Inca sexual slaves and therefore many Inca, half-Inca children who in rank would be above those not fathered by the Inca, but who would not be in line to the Inca throne. This goal of ethnic purity is reflected also in laws that forbade marriages among people of different towns. And hierarchical principles even affected laws stipulating the way people would dress and cut their hair. Now, Garcilaso shrewdly hides the Inca practice of institutionalized human sacrifice of young women and children principally that recent archaeological discoveries on the tops of mountains have exposed. Instead, Garcilaso credits the Incas with forbidding these sacrifices and the eating of human flesh that once upon a time, Garcilaso records for us, did occur in the region. He chooses his words carefully because he admits elsewhere that the Inca practiced the bloodletting of children for certain specialized ceremonies, but without reaching the point of killing them. Now, in the Incas' self-serving narrative, the Incas' civilizing work is so wonderful that the backward non-Inca Indians soon realize how much better they are under the Incas' rule and go around excitedly telling other Indians how much better it is to submit. I quote, the very same Indians just conquered, seeing themselves now different, and recognizing the benefits that they had received, with great contentment and happiness, went about the sierras, mountains, and bushlands, searching for other Indians, and would give them the good tidings of those children of the sun, and would tell them that for the good of everyone they had appeared in their land, and told the Indians of the many beneficial things they had done. End of quote. Now this narrative would be greeted with a howl if the conquerors were the Spaniards instead of the Inca. Another quote, the Canas wanted to know very carefully what the Inca commanded them to do, and what laws to take, and what gods to worship. And after knowing about it, they answered that they were happy to worship the sun and obey the Inca and keep his laws and customs because they seemed better than their own. And so they came out to greet the king and deliver themselves to him as obedient vassals. End of quote. Now, of course, some Indians apparently are too stupid or ungrateful to know what is good for them and resist or revolt against the Incas. They must then be duly punished. And one example among many is the Ayahuiti Nation. These Indians, I quote, were so obtuse and rebellious that neither persuasion nor promises nor the examples of the other Indians who had submitted worked. Instead, with obstinacy, they wanted to die, all of them, defending their freedom against everything that until then the Incas had experienced. How surprising. End of quote. Finally, the Inca beat them, and the Ayahuiti then joined the good side. Now, some conquests lasted years, not because the Indians were hard to beat, but because they were so stupid, Garcilaso tells us, that civilizing them took longer than defeating them. So was the case with the Indians from Hurinpacasa. Quote, one would spend more time in teaching them, so stupid they were, than in conquering them. End of quote. The stubborn and ungrateful Coyas, fortified on some heights, will have nothing to do with the Incas and tell them to go civilize somebody else. In spite of repeated generous offers from the Inca to surrender to a better life. I quote, the Coyas were always obstinate, saying that they had a very good way of life, that they did not want to improve it, and that they had their own gods, and that one of them was that mountain from which they were resisting, and that it would favor them, and that the Incas ought to go home in peace and teach to other Indians what they wanted, that they, the Coyas, did not want to learn it. End of quote. The Incas, of course, take on the Incas' burden and disinterestedly insist on civilizing them, which leads to a big battle and the defeat of the recalcitrant Indians. The Incas magnanimously pardon the rebels, but the ingrates rebel again, and now they must be subjugated a fuego y a sangre, through fire and blood. Finally, they submit. The Chinchas demonstrate a comparable, inexplicable obstinacy until the Inca ruthlessness overcomes them. Now, this pattern repeats itself many times in the narrative of Garcilaso all the way to his recording of the arrival of the Spaniards. Now, while reading this narrative justifying conquest and slavery, we must keep two things in mind. One is that Garcilaso laments that some Indian nations do not want to submit. Obviously, they want to keep their political independence. The notion of political collective freedom, obviously, is known to them at a practical level. We have no evidence, of course, that political freedom at the individual level was cherished or even known to them. The other thing is that the Amerindians are not alone in not having records indicating a conceptualization of freedom at the level of the individual man or woman. I know of no nation before classical Athens, and in some ways Sparta too, despite common notions to the contrary, that makes the freedom of the individual member of one's nation an explicit part of its political and therefore juridical system. In this, the Greeks are innovators, as in so many other things. However, not even the Greeks considered depriving other people of their freedom a problem. There are no Greek writings I know of questioning the moral validity of enslaving non-Greeks. In Greece, as in the entire world, slavery of others was taken for granted as a natural thing. So was the case in China, Japan, India, ancient Israel, the Islamic world until the 19th century, and early Western Europe. And this is when we get to the 16th century in Western Europe and Catholic Spain. For the first time, as far as I know, we have a debate, not a disquisition, but a debate on the right to deprive other people of their political liberty as a group, and of their personal freedom as individuals. This debate was provoked by the conquest of the New World by Catholic Spain, to be sure. But remember, conquests and enslaving in various forms had come and gone in the Americas, in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Africa, for centuries, even millennia. But no one had debated its justification and morality before the 16th century in Europe and within Europe in Catholic Spain. For the first time, we have a theoretical debate on the subject, and the issues and arguments in this debate are with us still today in not too transmogrified or even a well-disguised form. On the one side, we had a Catholic priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, and many followers who criticized, or at least questioned, conquering the Amerindians politically by means of war and directly or indirectly, overtly or surreptitiously, forcing them to serve the new conquerors. On the other side, we had a learned Renaissance Catholic humanist, Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda, who defended the need to conquer the Amerindians politically by means of war, though he claimed in the latest form of his argument not forcing them to serve the new conquerors. In this debate, it is the arguments used to criticize and justify the deprivation of political freedom and conquest that continues to be of interest today. And in a sort of poetic justice, Sepúlveda's arguments are not structurally different from those used by the Inca in Garcilaso's narrative. And I'll be very schematic here. This is a very complicated argument on both sides. Sepúlveda argued that a more civilized nation, and therefore one with a better ethical and political system, and this necessarily includes its religion, has the right and even the duty, the humanitarian duty, I would say today, to defeat another nation in war and impose on it its better ethical and political and therefore religious system. Sepúlveda justified this right and duty in a number of ingenious ways, and I can only mention a few, perhaps not doing him justice. One is that the conquering nation must stop what today we would call genocide, and that in Sepúlveda's time was called human sacrifice in a colossal scale, to the point of engaging in war every year merely to capture thousands of captives to be killed ritually for religious reasons. A related argument was that the religious beliefs and social organization of the conquered was what propitiated this genocide. Therefore, that religion and social organization must be replaced with a better one of the conquerors. He had other related arguments, for instance, that by and large the natives were very primitive and needed to be civilized and taught the better ways of doing things, and that the ones who were not that primitive had a horrible system anyway, and that Christianity demanded that one make salvation available to everyone, and so on and so on and so forth. Las Casas, on the other hand, claimed basically, again I'm simplifying his argument here, reducing it, he's very repetitive, claimed that one had no right to impose one's system on others, no matter how bad we thought the other system was. Regarding human sacrifice, Las Casas argued that Amerindians were doing what they thought was right. Indeed, we're worshiping God as devoutly as one can. What could be more devout than immolating human beings to God? I'm not kidding, he said that. Heck, even Abraham was willing to do it, though a bit reluctantly. And then Las Casas elaborated on this main argument against the main argument of Sepulveda by pointing out that at the very least, Christianity forbade violence against those who had not done us any harm, that killing and destroying people in order to save a lot of them from, doesn't make any sense. You know, killing a lot of people to save a lot of people, so this doesn't make any sense. You're doing the destroying in order to stop destruction, this doesn't make sense. That Amerindians were in fact civilized and had very admirable cultures. That they were good people, especially if you got to know them personally, and so on and so forth. Now, these two men's arguments may differ from those we have today in favor of against military interventions only in the details, but not in the underlying structure, and are more lucid on both sides than much that passes for political argumentation today. And I will conclude with perhaps a question to you that may be discussed later on, namely that one thing seems clear in this debate, and that is that there must have been something in European culture in general, and in Catholic Spain in particular, that first made possible, and perhaps even inevitable, this explicit, sophisticated, and comprehensive debate of a liberty and freedom in Europe and in Catholic Spain and nowhere else in the world. Thank you.